On the 21st of December 1978, police in Chicago were desperately trying to locate a missing teenager and had begun searching the home of a local maintenance contractor.
When they executed that search warrant, they went in the crawl space, and the very first shovel that they dug, they found human remains.
The man they had in custody, 36-year-old John Wayne Gacy, was a popular socialite who spent his weekends dressed as a clown, entertaining children.
At one point, chillingly, he says to the detectives, "You know, clowns can get away with murder." Well, never was a truer word said.
In total, Gacy the killer clown had tortured and killed 33 young men over a five-year period. 27 of the bodies were buried right beneath his own home.
Using other human beings, you know, inflicting pain and suffering and torture on another helpless human being, to me is the essence of evil.
The remorseless John Wayne Gacy had proved himself to be one of the world's most evil killers. Over the course of 6 years, John Wayne Gacy kidnapped, tortured, and brutally murdered 33 young men and boys in and around Chicago, Illinois. It was one of the most shocking sets of crimes in American history. The bodies of 27 of Gacy's victims were buried directly below the house he lived in. But this killer's story starts almost 40 years before. John Wayne Gacy was born in Chicago, Illinois, on the 17th of March, 1942. The second of three children, Gacy had a difficult upbringing. His father was an alcoholic who was reportedly both mentally and physically abusive to his children and their mother.
His father spent apparently all of Gacy's childhood demeaning him and physically punishing him and telling him how stupid and worthless and effeminate he was.
Gacy's childhood friend Barry Boschelli remembers the physical abuse he suffered at the hands of his father.
If Johnny was 2 minutes late, no food. So a lot of times Johnny ate at our house and stayed at our house overnight. He used to take Johnny when he was sitting at the kitchen table, and he would take his fist and hit Johnny in the face.
The father is a very significant figure in the genesis of Gacy's terrible deeds. For, to my mind, Gacy was always trying to satisfy his father, whom he never could. He was beaten repeatedly by his father with belts, with brooms. At one stage he was knocked out by him.
These people grow up with such a malignant view of the world and of human relationships, and feeling that human relationships are not based on love and trust and respect, you know, that they're all based on exploitation and cruelty and inflicting pain.
Gacy was a sickly child. He suffered from a heart condition, limiting his involvement in sports activities and consequently alienating him from his peers. Aged 11, an accident in a playground led to his teenage years being blighted by blackouts and hospital visits.
At that time, the swings were wooden base swings with heavy chains coming down. Johnny went to grab it, and the swing clipped him right across the forehead and knocked him to the ground.
By 1966, 24-year-old Gacy was married and had relocated to the city of Waterloo, 300 miles west of Chicago, in the neighboring state of Iowa.
Well, Gacy got married and life from the outside appeared to be relatively normal. He had quite a good job. His wife had two children. So they appeared to be the typical cereal box American nuclear family. And Gacy wasn't just a regular family man. He was also quite active in the local Chamber of Commerce, and he played quite an active role. And he was a real figure in the local community.
Gacy had started to build the perfect life for himself, but he was concealing a dark secret. He developed an unhealthy sexual interest in young boys.
There was a son of a fellow JC member who he lured back to his home and he sexually assaulted. So he's abusing power. He's getting into these positions of trust and he's taking advantage. And that's a theme that's going to continue for him.
And then when the kid revealed this to his father and Gacy was arrested for it, Gacy hired another teenager to intimidate this kid, to lure this kid into some remote place and spray mace in his eyes and beat him up and warn him against testifying in Gacy's case.
Despite Gacy's efforts, his victim still testified, but there wasn't conclusive proof of an attack. Therefore, police were only able to charge him with sodomy of the 15-year-old boy.
He pleaded guilty to one count of sodomy, thinking he would get a very, very minimal sentence. But the judge threw the book at him, and he was sentenced to 10 years in prison.
On the 3rd of December 1968, Gacy was sent to Anamosa State Penitentiary. Whilst in jail, Gacy's wife divorced him. A further blow was dealt when his father died, and he was denied permission to attend the funeral.
Given the perfect nature of Gacy's ability to groom whomever he came into contact with, within a matter of months, Gacy had become head cook at the prison, had convinced the staff that he was an absolutely ideal person. What's more, then convinced the parole board that he was no danger to anybody, and so served barely 18 months of the 10 years of his original sentence.
In June 1970, now aged 28, John Wayne Gacy was released from prison and returned home to Chicago. His friends, family, and neighbors were entirely unaware of what had taken place while he'd been living over 300 miles away in Iowa.
His background was not looked into in any way, I think partly because he didn't go into any line of work in which any kind of background check would have been necessary. You know, he began his own business. I mean, none of his acquaintance was even remotely aware of his criminal background.
In June 1972, Gacy got married for a second time, and he and his new bride set up home in the Chicago suburbs at 8213 West Summerdale Avenue. A house that would eventually become one of the most infamous addresses in America. 6 years later, in December 1978, 10 miles from Gacy's house, 15-year-old Des Plaines resident Rob Peast was reported missing by his mother. Detectives Mike Albrecht and Dave Hackmeister began to investigate the teen's disappearance.
Rob Peast was like a stellar kid. I mean, he was the kind of kid that anyone would want as a son. Never been in trouble, never had any inclination to run away. He was a good student, very, very much out of character. He would turn up missing. So, that caught our attention, obviously.
And at that time, in the late 70s, there was a lot of stuff going on with the hippie movement, all that kind of stuff. But he made a determination very quickly that this was not a normal, quote-unquote, runaway. He didn't have any girlfriend problems, was not involved in drugs or anything like that. He was just an all-American good kid.
At the time of his disappearance, Peace was working at a pharmacy in Des Plaines.
So he had told an employee and actually his mother that he was going to go talk to a contractor about a job. And he then went out the back door and he wasn't seen any time thereafter.
Rob Peace seemed to have just vanished off the face of the earth. The two detectives desperately needed to track down the contractor, who was probably the last person to see him. Their search would lead them to the door of a 36-year-old man by the name of John Wayne Gacy. He divorced his second wife 2 years previously and was now running a successful business called PDM Contractors. Gacy would often employ young men, one of whom was Tony Antonucci.
At the time when I met him, I was about 16 years old. And of course, like a lot of 16-year-olds, I wanted to get a job so I could afford to have my car. My first impressions were that he was basically a likable guy, kind of jovial, liked to joke around, appeared very normal.
Gacy seemed, in many ways, like the perfect boss.
Sometimes at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, John would say, hey, it's a nice day out, let's knock off early and have some fun or do something, and all normal stuff, you know, just kind of like you didn't expect, your boss to be the one that wanted to knock off early.
Another young man who'd come looking for a job was 15-year-old Rob Peast, but he hadn't been seen since meeting with Gacy at the pharmacy where he worked. Detectives Dave Hackmeister and Mike Albrecht were investigating.
We ran a records check on him, and as it turns out, he had a fairly lengthy background. He had spent some time in Iowa for sodomy, and so it was sexual crimes, basically, against children.
Concerned by Gacy's criminal record, the police obtained a warrant to search his home.
The warrant consisted of three facts. The first fact is that John Wayne Gacy, in fact, was at the pharmacy the night Rob Peast went missing. And fact two, that Rob Peast had told people that he was going to see a contractor regarding a job. And fact three, his criminal background. So on those three facts, they were able to obtain a search warrant.
On the 13th of December 1978, police conducted their first search of Gacy's home, finding a number of suspicious items.
They recovered various items of pornography. They recovered some books that were titled Pretty Boys Must Die. They also recovered driver's licenses of other young people, and they did a check on those driver's licenses. It was determined that those kids were also reported missing.
Initially, we were hoping to find Rob Peast alive someplace. And it didn't take long to realize that probably was not going to happen.
Another item recovered was a high school ring, which had belonged to missing 19-year-old John Schick, last seen in January 1977. Further investigation discovered that two of Gacy's employees had been reported missing. 17-year-old John Butkovich, last seen in July 1975, and Gregory Godzik, also 17 years old, missing since December 1976.
It was an evolution as we went along. I think it was after that search warrant, we're pretty confident there's at least five or six victims that were associated with Gacy that hadn't been seen.
But with no evidence or bodies, the police could not make an arrest. They decided to begin surveillance on Gacy.
We just said, wherever you go, we're going. If Gacy went into a public place, we were going to follow him in and see what he was up to.
Throughout this overt surveillance, we became fairly friendly with John Wayne Gacy. He knew we were following him. He tried to be cordial with us. In fact, he initiated conversations with us.
He'd play games with the police. He'd go up to their car and say, hi, do you guys want some marijuana? Or do something stupid like that.
He goes into Moose Lodge, and Mike and I, my partner and I, said, we're going to go in right along with Gacy, but we'll sit at a different table. All of a sudden, the waitress comes over with a couple of beers and places a beers in front of us and says, it's on that gentleman over there. We look over at John, and John gives us the high sign, and we wave back.
Very confident, cocky. Kept on bragging about all property and how much of a businessman he was and how well-connected he was.
John Wayne Gacy had a psychopathic personality, so he really does seek out power and he seeks out control, and he likes playing with people. He's a bit of a puppet master, and I think that was driving his behavior.
Everyone that we talked to just loved John Wayne Gacy. His neighbors, his co-workers, all of his associates, they loved the guy. And we could see that. I mean, the way he was interacting with us was basically the same. And my partner and I would have to, on many occasions, remind one another, hey, listen, you know, this guy is dangerous.
Gacy was considered an upstanding key member of his small community. He was popular and involved in politics. At weekends, he would even dress as a clown and perform for children at parties and at local hospitals.
The fact that Gacy had this other persona as Pogo the Clown, professional clowns usually, you know, will paint their smiles, you know, with sort of gentle circular things around their lips. Gacy's smile looks like bat wings. There's just something horrifically sinister and monstrous about this figure of Pogo. Just an element that raises Gacy to the level of a kind of mythic American monster.
At one point, chillingly, he says to the detectives, you know, clowns can get away with murder. Well, never was a truer word said. But it took some time for those detectives to fully comprehend that here was a man who was capable of murder, and more than one.
As Mike and Dave continued with their surveillance, detectives back at the station were trying to get another warrant to search Gacy's house. They'd received some disturbing new evidence while questioning his colleagues.
They're young kids, you know, 17, 18, 19 years old. And at times, Gacy had ordered these young kids to go down into his crawl space of his home and dig trenches. And he had told them that there was a sewage issue and that he needed the trenches dug so he could alleviate that situation. But they said that it happened several times and that there was an odor down there that was just unbelievable. So now we're starting to believe, hey, is it possible? I know it sounds crazy, but is it possible he could have buried someone in the crawl space?
He gets other people unwittingly involved in his offending, and they don't know anything of what's going on. And I think that's what gets him gratification, the fact that he has such power over other people, that they're not joining the dots together, and that he's able to hide in plain sight.
Mike and Dave continued to follow the popular contractor, but they had a plan to force Gacy's hand.
We were on the surveillance for about 7 days. And as the surveillance progressed, what we found out was that he had this huge core support of friends and family and coworkers and the such, and that is really what was the barrier between us and Gacy. So we developed a plan for the investigators to put some pressure on all of these people that were supporting him, and slowly they started peeling back from Gacy, and we were feeding Gacy information that they're possibly looking to execute a second search warrant. He became more and more desperate. And the last day, it was about midnight or 1 a.m, he contacted his attorneys and met his attorneys in their office in Park Ridge. At that point, Mike and I are outside and we see the attorneys waving us into the building. It was very uncharacteristic of the attorneys to do this.
The first thing they were telling us, though, is to park your cars in front of Gacy's and don't let him on. If he tries to move, shoot his tires out. You know, what's going on here?
It was very obvious to us that the attorneys were absolutely scared to death, petrified. They're pacing up and down. They won't take their eyes off of Gacy. And that pretty much solidified the fact to us that he had confessed to his attorneys about at least three murders.
Dave and Mike knew that Gacy was beginning to buckle. They continued to trail him as he left his attorney's office.
So we follow Gacy, and Gacy is driving like a madman, and he drives to the Shell gas station where he did all of his business. He goes in, and we see a transaction happen in the gas station.
It was very emotional, shaking his hand, almost on his side, hugging that kind of thing, and this is so out of context for Gacy.
So when Gacy comes back out, jumps in his car and takes off, I go back in the gas station. And when I go in there, they throw a couple of bags of marijuana at me, the employees. And they say, hey, listen, we didn't buy this. We didn't ask for it. Gacy just gave it to us.
As Gacy's behavior grew more and more erratic, the two detectives at least now had a reason to apprehend him.
We make a decision at that point to arrest him for the drug transaction that happened at the Shell gas station. So we cut off the car, pull Gacy out of the car, and arrest him for the drug transaction.
Devine in Milwaukee.
This was Gacy's final location of freedom.
That's it.
He was never free from this point on.
Grabbed him out of the car. He was all whining to us, why are you doing this to me and all that.
That's where it ended.
So technically, he was arrested for marijuana possession and delivery. And then we took him to the station.
While in custody, Gacy told detectives he was experiencing chest pains and was taken to a local hospital as a precaution. But he was just trying to buy some more time. The police had obtained the second warrant they'd been so desperate for. On the 21st of December 1978, they searched Gacy's home on West Somerdale Avenue for the second time.
When they executed that search warrant, they went in the crawl space, and the very first shovel that they dug, they found human remains.
Police had finally unearthed the secrets that Gacy had thought would stay buried forever.
So they immediately called me, let me know that there was human remains in a crawl space, and at that time I arrested John Gacy for murder. Gacy says he wants to confess, but really he wants to confess to the surveillance team, both myself and my partner and the other team. And now all of a sudden he's got an audience again, and he's on top of the world, and he knows he can't get out of it at this point, and so he might as well just divulge everything that actually happened.
Gacy told detectives he was willing to draw a map of the burial site beneath his home.
I gave him a pen, and he started right up. He squared it off in the thing, and he started, well, this was a double, and this was a triple, and this was the first guy with put an X on it. Went around the whole crawl space with these places where the body was buried. I mean, they were digging with spoons and everything, but they obviously identified where all the bodies were, and they did an overlay of where the bodies were actually found compared to that diagram that he made, and it was unbelievable. It was right on the money.
In total, 27 bodies were discovered in Gacy's crawl space. It wouldn't take long for news of this horrific discovery to filter out to the wider world.
Then the arrest came down, and that was the headline on the local papers, everything, how many bodies they took out of Gacy's basement.
Well, you know, when Gacy's crimes were uncovered, he entered into the record books, you know, as America's most prolific serial murderer. The notion that this, you know, pudgy, normal-seeming, decent, regular, ordinary guy was living in this horror house, you know, that was just suffused with the stench of death, and that there were the rotting bodies of 27 young men in his crawl space, bringing home and torturing young boys right in the midst, you know, of all his neighbors, and then going off to work the next day.
When we booked him for murder, we asked Gacy where he was born. And Gacy looked at us and said, "I was born in a state of confusion." And he smiled like that, and we captured the photo.
In total, Gacy confessed to the murder of 33 young men and boys between 1972 and 1978.
Gacy preyed on victims who he knew were not necessarily going to be missed by any family members. Rootless and homeless teenage boys who had no families that were going to miss them or care about their disappearance.
At that time, in the late 70s, kids were running away all the time, and a lot of these kids were reported missing, but there was no follow-up.
As it turns out, he had buried 27 young kids in the crawl space. He buried one of the young kids outside in his backyard, and he didn't have any room left on his property, so he threw 5 remaining victims in the Des Plaines River.
One of the bodies found floating in the Des Plaines River in April 1979 was that of Rob Peast, the 15-year-old boy whose disappearance had ultimately led to Gacy's downfall.
He was very descriptive on what he had done with Rob Peast.
Rob Peast's mom was waiting for him in the front parking lot, and Rob said to his mom, "Hey, I'm going to talk to a contractor about a job. I'll be right back." He goes back in the pharmacy. Gacy is in the back parking lot, the alleyway. And as Gacy's leaving, Rob follows him outside and says, "Excuse me, sir, I understand that you hire young kids, and I'm really interested in having a different job." And Gacy says, "Well, jump in the car, I'll have you fill out an application." So Gacy actually drives Peast willingly to Gacy's house. While there, Gacy starts showing Peast some little tricks of the trade of being a clown. He shows him a couple of card tricks. And the last trick that he shows Peast is the handcuff trick. Gacy actually handcuffs himself and turns around and struggles with the handcuffs and then turns back and he holds the handcuffs up. And Peast is pretty amazed at that. And he said, well, that's neat. How'd you do that? So Gacy says, well, here, you handcuff yourself and I'll show you how to do that. So Peast handcuffs himself and he struggles and he struggles and he struggles. And he looks at Gacy and he says, now, what's the trick to this? And Gacy reaches in his pocket and pulls out a key to the handcuffs. And he says, the trick is, you got to have this key.
This handcuff trick was part of an horrific yet clinical MO.
Gacy, throughout all of the 33 killings, had developed a method of killing these young kids.
He would pick up these victims. Some were kids who worked for him, but most were teenage runaways, you know, and bring them back to his house and giving them drinks. He would sort of trick them into handcuffing themselves or being handcuffed.
Gacy would use chloroform to subdue his victims. Chloroform's an old-fashioned anesthetic, really, so it gets into your lungs and it just renders you unconscious very effectively.
He did what he called the rope trick. And when he had these young kids incapacitated like that, he would slip a rope over their neck, a knotted rope like a loop, and then put the stick in the back like a tourniquet, and he would slowly turn the tourniquet. And he said he had it perfected so well that he knew exactly how the body would react to each half turn.
Putting a ligature around the neck, the first thing it's going to block is the blood vessels, so it prevents blood getting to the brain, prevents it getting back to the body from the brain. It's going to be very uncomfortable, and it can even render you unconscious in a small number of seconds.
And he went into detail on how he would torture these young men. And he, in fact, did double and triple murders. He would incapacitate two or three people at a time and kill one person in front of the other victims, and then continue to kill the other victims. And he seemed to be pretty proud of that. We used that to our advantage to keep him talking, and he described every killing to a T, exactly how it happened, all 33.
As the news broke across the country, one shocked viewer who'd unknowingly experienced Gacy's MO firsthand was his ex-employee, Tony Antonucci. Whilst working for PDM, Tony had accidentally got a nail stuck in his foot.
John took me and I got a tetanus shot and took me home. And he came over later that evening to check on if I was okay, or that was the theory. But he also had, you know, some wine and we were drinking and he was kind of joking around. It was probably 10:30 at night. I was a high school wrestler. And he said, oh, you know, you're a big wrestler guy. And he started wrestling around with me. He got my left arm, and he got it behind me, and I felt him put a handcuff on it. I kept flailing my right hand around so that he couldn't get my right arm. But eventually, he did get a hold of my right arm, and he knocked me down to the floor with my hands behind me. He left the room for a few minutes, and I realized that if I pulled really hard on my right hand, that I could pull my hand through the handcuff. I could get it out.
By pretending he was still handcuffed, Tony was able to catch Gacy unawares when he returned and turn the situation to his advantage.
I took the handcuff that I had gotten out of, and I handcuffed him on one of his wrists, and I reached into his pocket, got the key, and I handcuffed him behind his back, laying face down. He goes, you're the only one that not only got out of the handcuffs, you got them on me. And I didn't know what that meant. I thought that this was some type of test that he had performed before. And I let him stay handcuffed for 10 or 15 minutes before I let him out of the handcuffs. And, you know, he had previously agreed that when I let him up, he would leave. And he did.
Tony had no idea just how close he'd come to being another victim of this deadly killer.
I did not fear for my life, and not fearing for my life and not panicking is probably what saved my life. Because I'm sure if when I got out of the handcuffs, if I tried to run for the door or do something, you know, he was 33 years old and very strong, and I was 16 or 17. I'm sure he could have overpowered me if he knew he had to.
Tony continued working for PDM for a few months after the attack and only reported the incident after Gacy's arrest. By the time the case went to trial, police had managed to identify the remains of 22 of the victims.
So with Gacy, we have around 30 bodies, different states of decomposition, some of which have been there for many years. Forensically, that sort of scene is a nightmare. You've got so many different things to dig up. It's a very complex procedure. It's very hard work. It will involve a lot of people and a lot of time.
Seven of Gacy's victims have never been identified. This close-knit community on the outskirts of Chicago was baffled beyond belief that such a monster had lived amongst them for so long.
One of the effects that learning about these crimes has on the public is that it sort of reduces you to a state of childlike awe and terror and wonder. You know, you can imagine all these middle American suburbanites. Suddenly, here are the authorities bringing out the decomposed remains of young men that have been stored in the crawl space of your neighbor's house.
A horrified public were both shocked and outraged by the crimes Gacy had committed. As the state prepared their case, they were determined to ensure that the man who'd been held in such high esteem by his local community would pay for his crimes in full. The trial of John Wayne Gacy began on February the 6th, 1980, at the Cook County Criminal Courts building in Chicago. At the time, Illinois still had the death penalty. Gacy's defense team were pleading insanity.
It was an interesting trial, and what was so fascinating about it was they had so many different psychiatrists saying so many different things that they all came up with different diagnoses, which really goes towards this picture of this non-intact human being, this bits and pieces of person.
During the five-week trial, the prosecution were desperate to prove that Gacy was fully responsible for his actions.
There's a difference between psychopathy and mental illness. Psychopaths are rational. They know what they're doing and they know what they do is wrong, but they decide to do it anyway. So he was fully culpable for his crimes.
He was vicious, he was evil. He was not insane in any way. He knew exactly what he was doing. And he killed these people for self-preservation because he was so well-liked politically and business-wise, he couldn't have his public out that he was taking advantage of these kids.
One of the prosecution witnesses was Gacy's former employee, Tony Antonucci, who'd been attacked by the 37-year-old contractor.
I saw him in court, and he was off to my left, sitting at the table where the defense attorneys are, and he just stared straight forward. He was fairly far away. I might have caught his eye on occasion in the courtroom, but I was pretty nervous to be on a witness on a trial of that significance, even at that age, in my early 20s.
On the 13th of March, 1980, the jury had made their decision on the fate of John Wayne Gacy.
It didn't take long for them to find him guilty. I think it took maybe less than 3 hours, which was amazing. And then he was found guilty.
It was kind of amazing how fast everything went. When you look at other trials that have gone on, this trial went extremely fast.
In the final moments of the trial, one of the prosecutors, William Kunkel, called him a ruthless, sadistic killing machine. And I think that's a pretty apt description.
Judge Louis B. Garippo sentenced Gacy to death. He was immediately taken to the Menard Correctional Center, Illinois, where he would remain on death row for 14 years. Whilst in jail, he took up painting, selling his artwork for profit.
even when he was behind bars, he continued to control and manipulate people. He produced several paintings, several works of art, which he sold. And he maintained a legacy even after his death through those paintings. So he was still in control when he was behind bars. He still had power over other people, and he was still able to make choices and decisions.
The profits he gained from these paintings resulted in the government suing him for his earnings. Lawyer Karen Conti took on Gacy's case against the state.
Gacy liked to paint, and he was a terrible, terrible painter. And he painted horrible things like skulls and clowns and creepy things like that. But people bought them, and they paid $200 a shot for him to paint these ugly pictures. So that's the first thing he wanted to talk to us about. But we went down there knowing that what we wanted to do was represent him in the death penalty. What was surprising was he looked and acted just like anybody else, like your favorite uncle, like your next door neighbor. And if you think about it, that's probably why he got away with killing so many boys and men, because he didn't look evil. You could not reconcile what he did with the man you were talking to.
Karen was a firm opponent of the death penalty and represented Gacy during his final appeals against the sentence.
Over the years, Gacy had numerous appeals, and our system allows that. Appeals in the federal court, appeals in the state court. By the time that Gacy had his execution date set, we were out of traditional appeals.
There are certain serial killers, even staunch anti-death penalty advocates, would not protest against the execution of somebody like Gacy. If he felt any twinge of feeling sorry, it was only feeling sorry for himself. You know, these people are possessed of this incredibly malignant narcissism. The only thing that they are capable of feeling anything for is themselves and their own needs.
When you have a client who has committed these horrific acts, 33 murders, no court is going to want to let him out. No court is going to want to change execution to life in prison because it's politically a disaster. Gacy had to be executed, and no matter what we alleged, even if we had really, really good arguments, I don't think anyone would have listened because it was John Gacy.
In a CBS TV interview filmed in Menard Correctional Center in May 1992, Gacy recanted his confession and tried to deny that he was guilty of any of the murders.
He claimed that he was a victim of circumstance and clearly innocent. Now, that was balderdash. He was guilty of sin, but nevertheless, it just proved what an extraordinary man he was. And throughout the interview, you can see the interviewer looking more and more astounded by Gacy's relaxation. He didn't look nervous. He looked absolutely composed, relaxed, if anything, a little angry. Why am I being put through this? It's not fair. It was a pure accident. I never did it.
We knew it was his last-ditch effort. You know, everything else failed. He thought he could get away with, insanity plea, and that didn't work. So it was last-ditch effort to say that he wasn't involved or that others participated. But it was very clear during his initial confession that he was the one who completed these crimes and completed them by himself.
Gacy never took responsibility for his actions, and he would always blame others. He would blame his victims, and in some cases, he blamed his victims' parents. He would turn around and say, well, it's not my fault. I'm completely, you know, not responsible for any of this. And that's a key psychopathic trait, the failure to take responsibility for their own actions.
Despite numerous attempts to appeal his death sentence, on the 10th of May 1994, John Wayne Gacy was executed by lethal injection at Stateville Penitentiary in Illinois.
It was a circus. We were in a room at some point, and we saw a television screen, and we saw thousands of people lined up at least a mile down the street at the prison with signs, kill the clown, kill Gacy, with our names on it, kill Karen Conti. People beating drums, people dancing, people with clown makeup on. It was a celebration.
Gacy's last words were, "Kiss my ass." Those are the words of a man who absolutely didn't mind what he'd done, who was proud of himself and proud of that killing spree, which makes him particularly chilling.
Gacy was unrepentant right up until his last moments. He clearly felt no remorse for any of his 33 victims.
Using other human beings, you know, inflicting pain and suffering and torture on another helpless human being, to me, is the essence of evil.
After the execution, you think there'd be closure, but there really isn't closure for something like that. I mean, you always think back to the victim's family and the poor young boy who was 15 years old and just a good kid. So as much as you'd like to believe there was closure, there really wasn't closure.
40 years after being attacked, Tony Antonucci feels relieved he didn't become one of Gacy's many victims.
I do feel very lucky to be alive. I don't know what to attribute that to. You know, maybe I, you know, luck definitely the biggest component, you know, a little bit of help from above. And basically my own ignorance of the fact that I was truly in danger and the fact that I didn't panic and just wanted to win the game, if it was a game, is probably what helped. I also would have been one of the earlier victims, so I'm sure his techniques became more honed after he was divorced and lived alone and had more freedom to act differently.
John Wayne Gacy remains one of the most infamous killers in American history. His horrific murders continue to haunt the nation to this day.
I still get weird emails. I still get weird things where people lash out and say terrible things to me about representing Gacy. So as Gacy said to me, you know, your obituary will read Karen Conti represented serial killer John Gacy. And although I won't be around to verify that, I have no doubt that's what it will read.
For kids, monsters are real. As you become an adult, you realize, well, there are no real werewolves, there are no real vampires. But then something like this happens and, you know, it's like, whoa, you know, this monster is real. You know, there is this ogre. It's transfixing, it's riveting. You know, it's fascinating in the most horrifying way.
Gacy was the epitome of evil. And he was the epitome of being a great guy, which gave him the ability to be the most evil guy in the world.
Gacy's outward persona of a charming socialite helped to keep his crimes hidden for over 5 years. But behind the mask of this friendly clown was a sadistic killer who cruelly and savagely ended the lives of 33 young men by torturing them in the most hideous of manners, all for his own selfish sexual gratification. His lack of remorse for any of his victims or their loved ones, right up until the day he was executed, proved that he is, without doubt, one of the world's most evil killers. Seattle, Washington, November the 5th, 2003. The King County Superior Court. In front of a packed room, 54-year-old killer Gary Ridgway pleaded guilty to 48 counts of aggravated murder.
Gary Ridgway is probably the most prolific serial killer in America, if not the world.
He was a killing machine, a man of extraordinary evil.
When another body was found years later, the terrible death toll hit 49.
He's preying on sex workers or young women who have run away from home, people who are vulnerable. He disposes of their bodies in the Green River.
Among the many victims were young girls who'd run away from home.
She was a little girl when she was murdered by him.
She deserved the best of everything. She deserved to have a very happy life.
Despite police suspicions, it took nearly 20 painstaking years to gather enough evidence to convict Ridgway for the murders.
I poked him with my finger in his chest. I says, "You SOB, I know you did it, and we're going to get you."
The man who became known as the Green River Killer murdered 49 young women and is suspected of killing many more. All that makes Gary Ridgway one of the world's most evil killers. Seattle, Washington, 1982. It was here in the Pacific Northwest where arguably the most prolific serial killer of all time, Gary Ridgway, aka the Green River Killer, preyed on vulnerable young women, runaways, and sex workers.
Gary Ridgway gets a special place in the role of serial killers because we're talking about a man who's responsible clearly for killing at least 49 women.
After he's murdered his victims, he disposes of their bodies in the Green River. Victims' bodies are found in the river, they're found weighted down, and he hasn't just raped and killed these women. He has extended his power and control over them, so some are found with objects inserted inside them, stones, essentially.
This was a killing machine operating in plain sight. What could be more horrifying? If you walked out into the street and said, "Good morning, Gary," you would not say for 1 second that Ridgway was a serial killer.
Elaine Porterfield was a young reporter with the Seattle Post-Intelligencer at the time.
He was viewed as largely unremarkable and almost kind of uninteresting, maybe a little bit odd. Gary was a truck painter for a famous truck building company here in Seattle.
With his unassuming persona, Ridgway was able to commit mass murder for nearly 20 years and get away with it. The fear across the Pacific Northwest was palpable.
I think that this case really did have a significant impact on the community. There'd been this serial killer on the loose for many, many years who was named the Green River Killer. And this person didn't have an identity. He was this faceless monster.
Every time a body was found, it was thought that it could be attributed to the Green River Killer. And that included some cases in Oregon and all the way up to British Columbia. And it was terrifying to women going out by themselves.
Virginia Graham's sister, Deborah Estes, was one of Ridgway's victims.
You know, we're both small. She's was about, you know, my same height. You know, she loved the color purple. That was her favorite color. And she absolutely adored horses. She loved horses.
Deborah disappeared in September 1982.
You cannot begin to, unless you've lived that, you can't begin to understand this specific hell on earth that really is.
Candace Diskin's younger sister went missing in 1987.
My sister's name was Roberta Joseph Hayes. Bobby Joe, that was her nickname. I think of her often. I don't know, she just had a big, beautiful smile and big blue eyes, and she was a funny kid.
Bobby Joe's body was not found for 4 years. All the while, Candace suspected the worst, that her sister had been murdered by the Green River Killer.
It was a really tough time not knowing where so many people's loved ones, their daughters, their, you know, where they were, what was happening to them.
Sergeant Frank Atchley and his partner Bob LaMoria served jointly as supervisors on the Green River Task Force. They and their fellow detectives worked tirelessly to track down the man who was arguably the most prolific mass murderer in U.S. history.
We were finding victims two or three times a week during certain periods of time during the investigation.
We had victims that were missing for over 2 years, had never been reported missing. So it made it easy for Mr. Ridgway to get away with it as long as he did, because we were sometimes 2 and 3 years behind him.
This killer's story begins over 70 years ago. Gary Ridgway was born in Salt Lake City, Utah, in 1949.
The middle of three sons to a ferocious, domineering mother and a bus driver father. His parents argued relentlessly, but he always took his mother's side. The mother was to become the most signal figure in his life.
The other thing about his mother is this. Up till roughly age 13, he had a bedwetting problem, and his mother would deal with his problem by personally washing his genitalia. This kind of behavior is very unusual. It is going to inevitably lead to a confusion about sexuality. And indeed, Ridgway admitted to his psychiatrist that he had lustful sexual feelings towards his mother.
As a teenager, he was obsessed with sex.
By the time he reaches adolescence, Ridgway has got what could only be described as a supercharged sex drive. He wants sex all the time, everywhere, regardless.
Ridgway struggled in school and was held back two grades.
There's also problems with his peers. He's always the slow one. He's always a bit behind. So always being the odd one out, not having that sense of belonging. And one of the things that Gary Ridgway learned to protect himself was to be violent, was to instill fear in other people, because that was a kind of armor.
Age 16, Ridgway viciously attacked a six-year-old boy.
He actually stabs the boy seriously in the liver, and the child survives. This episode hints that there is some completely psychotic, disorganized process going on just below the surface with him.
Ridgway was not identified, so was never charged with the assault. In 1969, he joined the U.S. Navy. The following year, Ridgway married his first wife, but his mother was still ever present in their relationship.
This is a woman who was so dominating that even after he got married, his mother would decide what clothes to buy him and that he should wear.
Soon after getting married, Ridgway was deployed on a tour with the U.S. Navy. Unable to contain his sexual urges, he regularly visited prostitutes.
Wherever he was, he visited sex workers. And in several cases, he contracted venereal diseases, which he was angry about, and which he held against the sex workers. And I think that just fed on itself, that anger, that hatred, that depersonalization of these women.
When Ridgway returned the following year, he found his wife had been dating another man. The couple divorced in January 1972. A year later, in 1973, he found a new wife. While he was married, Ridgway also found a new outlet for his passions.
Ridgway suddenly became something of a religious zealot, a Bible thumper. He would proselytize. He's kind of fervent, almost out of proportion, his interest in religion.
Religion plays a very interesting role for some subset of serial killers. The problem is that religion, psychology, medications, none of them have proven more powerful than the urge to kill in a serial killer.
Ridgway and his new wife had a son. On the surface, they seemed like an ordinary, God-fearing, all-American family.
Part of him was still a sex maniac. And another part of him was very guilty about that. So you have what you might describe as the Jekyll and Hyde character. Dr. Jekyll, a religious, caring, good husband. And you have Mr. Hyde, of course, who is still going to prostitutes regularly.
Visiting prostitutes at night and with his mother ever present in their relationship, Ridgway's second marriage ended in divorce in 1981. Soon after, he had his first run-in with the law when he was arrested in 1982 for soliciting a prostitute. The minor charge would be an ominous sign of the women he would prey on and the monstrous murders that he was about to commit. Driven by an insatiable sex drive, Ridgway had started to pick up street prostitutes from the SeaTac Strip, the road that connects Seattle to the neighboring city of Tacoma.
This is a highway that was frequented by sex workers at the time.
Ridgway's first victim was just 16 years old. One night after work, he picked the sex worker up from the strip. Sergeant Frank actually supervised the task force assigned to catch him.
These women were in the area of Pacific Highway South, and that's where he would make contact with them and abduct them, okay? And usually these were after hours, during the hours of darkness. How he would get them into his car is anybody's guess.
Ridgway took his first victim to a desolate location along the banks of the Green River, just outside Seattle's city limits. The body of the 16-year-old was found on July the 15th, 1982. Detectives later determined that she'd been murdered about a week earlier. Sergeant Bob Lemuria supervised the search at the first crime scene.
The first victim apparently floated down the river and got tangled up in some brush and the rocks, and her body was exposed in plain view.
Her kidnap and killing in July 1982 would set a sinister pattern that would result in 49 confirmed murders. Ridgway typically targeted young women drawn to the peace and promise of America's Pacific Northwest.
He's preying on vulnerable women, so women who are either sex workers or young women who have run away from home.
They were young women doing the best they could in the way they knew how. They were 15, 16, 17 years old, 20 years old.
After his first murder, Ridgway went on a frenzied killing spree. In just 5 weeks, he picked up five more women from the SeaTac Strip. By August the 15th, 1982, Ridgway had kidnapped, raped, and callously killed all of them. He dumped one of the bodies near a creek and four in the Green River. The defiled bodies were found in clusters along the banks.
The homicides started in, 1982, and the publicity that was being received or broadcasted by the news media, every member of this county, the state of Washington, the United States, were aware of these murders.
In August of 1982, a task force was formed to catch the so-called Green River Killer. The team scoured the area and made a series of grim discoveries.
This was the site of three of the victims. There were two upstream a ways, pushed into the water and weighted down with rocks. A third one was left on the bank in the tall grass. I assume that he thought he was going to get caught. He saw somebody and dumped the body and ran because she didn't make it in the water.
When the call came out, we would have dispatched the task force. We'd set up a perimeter. We'd line up and we would clip every blade of grass, looking for any hairs, fibers, or anything else that might be of investigative value.
Analyzing the bodies, detectives quickly determined a pattern in the killer's behavior. He would head to the SeaTac Strip after work. There, he would pick up a sex worker from the side of the road. The women did not know it, but then their fate was sealed.
His method of operation, his MO, was taking these women to wooded, isolated areas, sometimes along riverbanks, along stretches of road, so that he would see any approaching vehicles and give him plenty of time to avoid being seen.
Ridgway would park and persuade the women to get out of his truck. Then he would attack.
Each victim was manually strangulated. And the fact that he admitted to the pleasure he sought out of watching the life seep out of each of the bodies, I feel that is horrific.
What is more, Ridgway's victims had no idea it was coming.
Ridgway strangled many of his victims from behind. It gives him, first of all, the element of surprise. It reduces the likelihood they can effectively fight back against him. in those few seconds before his victims became unconscious, they would be shocked, they would be struggling to breathe, they would be in pain, they may be trying to fight back. In about 10 seconds, somebody will be unconscious and unable to respond to you.
He started off strangling with his hands, but increasingly they put up a fight. He bruised his arms, and he didn't want to have to explain that to his friends or to his son. And so he started using ligatures, because it meant he didn't have to put his hands on their throat.
By the end of the summer of 1982, Ridgway had kidnapped, murdered, and then raped 9 young women.
He would pick up sex workers and murder them and then dispose of their bodies in clusters. So there would be dump sites where there were several bodies of his victims.
The next group that we found was on the Starlake Road. He would park on a curve so that he could see in both directions, and then he would carry the bodies out and deposit them.
Ridgway later confessed to having had sex with the bodies after death, in some cases, long after.
The necrophilia, having sex with a dead person, is extraordinarily rare. And it's one of the pieces of the puzzle that suggests true psychosis. To engage in necrophilia, you have to be completely out of touch with reality.
Ridgway would often revisit the bodies of his victims multiple times. He would move them, he would have sexual relations with the bodies. It's absolutely ghastly.
Deborah Estes was one of the many runaways that Ridgway targeted. Virginia Graham was 16, a year and a half older than her sister Deborah, when she disappeared in the summer of 1982.
We were so close in age, but she had shorter blonde hair.
Like many who take to the streets, Deborah ran away from what was an abusive family situation. In Deborah's case, her father was the alleged abuser.
You're literally living with a rattlesnake. That rattlesnake can be calm one second and can just absolutely, if you are not hypervigilant around watching and you drop your guard for just 1 minute, you can seriously get hurt or even die.
On one fateful night in July of 1982, home life became too much to bear for 14-year-old Deborah.
Probably 2-3 o'clock, maybe somewhere around there, my mom woke up and noticed that my stepdad, Debbie's biological father, was coming out of my sister's bedroom. And my mom asked him, well, what are you doing? And he said, well, I'm just checking on her like any good father would do. So, and no, he wasn't. He was there for a totally different reason. And she left the next day, early, very early.
For Virginia, it's a moment that she still struggles with.
I would have grabbed her and I would have held on to her. And I don't know what we could have done because she was 14 years old.
Deborah's mother reported her as missing to the Seattle police soon after. On September the 20th, 1982, Deborah was brought to a police station. She'd reported that she'd been raped by a client a week earlier and was there to see photos of the suspect. It turned out that the man who attacked Deborah was another serial rapist that was also active in the area. Just after she talked to law enforcement, a detective dropped her off at the motel that she was living in. Deborah was never seen again. She was just 15 years old.
Well, the same day that she got dropped off by the detective investigating the serial rape cases was the same day that Gary Ridgway picked her up.
Deborah's desecrated body was found nearly 6 years later. She'd been dumped in the debris of a building site just down the road from where she'd been abducted.
From where he picked her up to where he took her to kill her, she maybe would have lived no more than an hour, hour and a half at the most from the time he picked her up. By the time, you know, they drove and everything took place and he buried her, no more than an hour and a half. So, Boy, that's a sobering thought.
By the end of 1982, the death toll wrought by the Green River Killer had reached 11. By dumping the bodies in the river and in the woods, hard evidence was difficult to come by.
If a body is disposed in water, then quite clearly a few things will happen. Evidence can be washed away, trace evidence, DNA, blood stains and blood patterns will be washed away, so it reduces the forensic opportunities. If the body is there for a long time, decomposition will hamper the examination.
Even though they found many bodies during the summer of 1982, the Seattle-based task force had no idea who the perpetrator might be.
Our suspect pool was basically every male over 17 or 18 years old in the entire world. And we didn't know whether he was coming from someplace else, flying in or driving in or what.
With the news of 11 women now murdered and their mutilated bodies found by the banks of the Green River, as well as in the local woods, fear spread across America's Pacific Northwest. A mysterious mass murderer known as the Green River Killer was still on the loose. A truck painter by day and a serial killer by night, 33-year-old Gary Ridgway was hiding in plain sight and living in a quiet Seattle neighborhood.
The police in the area were struggling because who would suspect Gary Ridgway's inoffensive, talkative, plain, ordinary-looking man? There was no horn, there were no tails. He wasn't wearing a great black cloak. Gary Ridgway was the man next door. You would not have noticed him.
He's your average Joe. He's somebody who fits in. He's somebody who you wouldn't be scared of because he doesn't look like a monster.
The killer was preying on young, vulnerable runaways who worked the streets near the SeaTac airport.
He knows that he's got an easy target group here, so that's going to allow him to get away with it for an awfully long time.
Ridgway would simply pick young women up from the side of the road as they solicited sexual services.
I don't think any of them would have believed that somebody who looked as inoffensive and as Joe average as Gary Ridgway would be capable of murder.
After what seemed a lull over the winter when no new bodies were found, in the spring of 1983, Seattle's serial killer struck again. In the evening of April the 30th, Ridgway drove to the SeaTac Strip, where he picked up 18-year-old Marie. Like so many of his victims, she sold sex to survive. She also had a boyfriend who acted as her pimp. When he saw her get in Ridgway's truck, his gut feeling told him something was not right, so he decided to follow them.
The boyfriend saw her get into the car and he was trying to go to her rescue, but he couldn't because he got stopped at an electrical signal light.
When she didn't return home, a few days later, Marie's anxious boyfriend and her father desperately searched the area.
The boyfriend and the girl's father drove around the areas trying to find it, and they were worried about the girl because they were also aware of the Green River murders.
The two men made a remarkable discovery.
While patrolling while driving around checking the areas for their girlfriend and daughter, they found this truck that matched the description that the boyfriend had seen, and it turned out to be Gary Ridgway's.
Ridgway's distinctive truck sat in the driveway as a detective questioned the 34-year-old car painter at his house. With Marie nowhere to be seen, the officer did not pursue the lead. Marie's badly decomposed body would be found 20 years later. However, Ridgway would remain on the police's radar. But in the spring of 1983, the killer slipped through the net. Just a few days later, on May the 3rd, he killed again. This time, he radically changed his MO. He attacked 21-year-old Carol Ann, a local waitress and a single mother.
Carol Ann was somebody who wasn't a sex worker. She was somebody who knew Gary Ridgway, and that the two of them had sex. And afterwards, Gary Ridgway had strangled her. But it wasn't enough for him to just kill her. He engaged in some rather bizarre behaviour with Carol Ann's body. So he put a grocery bag over her head. He left two gutted fish on her body. He draped an empty bottle of wine over her torso. And he'd left ground-up sausage meat on her hands.
Carol Ann's body was found some 20 miles east of the SeaTac Strip in Maple Valley, Washington.
This woman was different than the other victims. It was maybe the only time or the first time that he killed a non-prostitute. And what do we know about Ridgway's response to doing this? He did something that I've almost never heard of in a serial killer. He laid beside the body, and he cried. And crying is something serial killers don't do. And what I would like to suggest this tells us, what it teaches us, is that even the devil himself has a moment where he sees clearly enough what depravity and evil wreaks in his soul to be touched humanly.
By the end of the year, the desecrated bodies of 24 women had been found by shocked passers-by. Many more had been reported missing, and the suspicion was that they too were the victims of the Green River Killer. Body parts were scattered all over the Pacific Northwest.
He's been dumping bodies up and down the Green River, taking some of them to the neighboring state of Oregon.
The Green River Task Force spent countless hours and days carefully gathering all the fragments of evidence they could from across the Northwest.
The task force investigators were spending a lot of time on bone finds. We would launch the whole entire task force and spend a lot of investigative time only to find out at the end that it was an animal bone.
All the while, the killing of young women continued. By the end of 1984, the toll of victims had reached 42. Sadly, the police were nowhere nearer to stopping the Green River Killer.
Believe me, all of the investigators wanted so much to solve this case and prevent somebody else from being killed.
Frank Atchley was brought in to supervise the Green River Task Force in May of 1984 in the hope of finally solving the case.
These detectives, each and every one of them, put their heart and soul into solving this investigation. For each victim that was found, it impacted the morale of the detectives who were hoping that there would be no more victims of the Green River Killer.
The next year, 1985, Ridgway met the woman who would become his third wife at a Parents Without Partners meeting.
They seem to have quite an idyllic relationship. She thinks very highly of him. He's somebody who is a kind of pillar of the community. His third wife provided quite a lot of assistance to Gary in terms of looking after his finances and that kind of thing. So things that he wasn't particularly capable of doing himself.
At the same time, the killing spree seemed to slow.
His third wife was later to say, "I think I saved many lives because I loved him." It's a most poignant remark, and one that strikes to the heart. You embrace a serial killer and you save lives. I don't think for a moment she thought he was a serial killer when she married him, but my goodness, I find it heartbreaking.
But Ridgway's urge to kill could not be stopped for long. The man who had now killed 46 women picked up 21-year-old Bobby Joe Hayes in February 1987. Her sister Candice recalls those trying times.
In 1991, her remains were found. So 4 years after she went missing, her remains were found on Highway 410 outside of Seattle in Auburn. So that was terrible for the family, as you can imagine.
Like so many of the young women that Ridgway kidnapped and killed, Bobby Jo sold sex to survive. A single mother of five, she was known to frequent the SeaTac Strip, Ridgway's hunting ground. Bobby Jo also worked the streets of Portland, 2.5 hours south of Seattle.
I would see her, you know, downtown. I would see her on Aurora Avenue, near where we grew up.
Though they shared the same mother, Candace's sister, Bobby Jo, lived with their father and his new wife.
She wasn't treated very well. There was a lot of drinking involved. So she pretty much ventured out on her own at about age 12, hit the streets. You know, I would see her with her Johns. I would see, and you know, my heart just broke. She deserved the best of everything. She deserved to have a very happy life. And that I'm sorry for not being able to help her more. That's probably all.
When Bobby Jo's remains were finally found, it ended years of torment for Candace and her family.
Not knowing can be just as hard as knowing. It's bittersweet. Nothing good about it, but I no longer have to drive Aurora Avenue looking for my sister, because that's what I did for years. I'd be driving and I was just constantly aware of myself looking for her, hoping to see her with a John, you know, or in somebody's car or something.
By the spring of 1987, the death toll wrought by the Green River Killer had reached 46. When some green carpet fibers were found among the remains of several of the victims, a warrant was issued to search the home and workplace of Gary Ridgway, who was already on the police's radar.
The fibers, as it turned out, showed that some of the victims had been in the same environment before or after they were killed.
1 month after Bobby Jo disappeared, on April the 8th, 1987, the Green River Task Force searched the home of Gary Ridgway. A young couple renting rooms above Ridgway's garage helped with their inquiries.
They showed us photographs that they had taken inside the house that showed it had a green tribal-type carpet in there.
Frank Atchley and a team of detectives entered Ridgway's home.
I saw Ridgway at the house, and he was smug, and his mother was there, and she was screaming and hollering that we had the wrong guy and so on and so forth. That's when I poked him with my finger in his chest. I says, "You SOB, I know you did it, and we're going to get you one of these days."
April the 8th, 1987 was not that day.
We found no remnant or anything of that carpet. It had all been removed, replaced. And even the vacuum cleaner didn't reveal anything that helped us. He had really cleaned up the place.
Detectives also searched Ridgway's job site in Renton, Washington, where he worked as a truck painter.
It was 87. We served search warrants on his place of employment. When we got him back to the precinct, they took a swab of his, had him chew on a piece of gauze, which was ultimately his coup de grace.
It would take 14 more years and a breakthrough in technology, but the saliva-soaked gauze with the killer's DNA sealed in promised to reveal the true identity of the Green River Killer. Seattle, Washington State, 2001. Since 1982, the serial killer had taken at least 48 young lives with impunity. But thanks to groundbreaking advances in forensic technology at the turn of the 21st century, the net was finally closing in on the man next door, 52-year-old Gary Ridgway.
Arguably the most prolific serial killer the United States has ever seen, outranking even Bundy or Jeffrey Dahmer. He looks inoffensive, but is in fact dreadful, a man of extraordinary evil.
At the Washington State Crime Labs in 2001, Dr. Beverly Himmick took advantage of a new technique in forensic technology.
It takes a breakthrough in DNA technology to finally trap Gary Ridgway, a man who's been getting away with murder for close to 20 years.
Call short tandem repeat or STR DNA testing, the detectives re-examined the saliva that was captured in the gauze they'd asked Ridgway to submit 14 years earlier.
When we started the investigation, DNA was just coming on the scene in the United States. And the thing that we finally got Ridgway on, the DNA, had been submitted two, three, four times previous for processing, but it kept coming back inconclusive. It wasn't until 2001 we got a positive hit on him.
As they were gathering evidence against him in the autumn of 2001, Gary Ridgway suddenly re-emerged.
Whilst Gary Ridgway might have stopped killing for a period of time, he has not completely turned around his behaviour or his lifestyle. In 2001, he is picked up by a police officer as he is soliciting a sex worker.
He makes the mistake of picking up an undercover police officer whom he mistakes for a prostitute, and that led to his arrest.
Alerted to the incident and concerned that he might kill again, law enforcement decided to act. On November the 30th, 2001, they arrested Gary Ridgway.
It was unbelievable. I think at that point, people didn't believe that he would ever be caught. It was absolutely stunning and gratifying. There was a giant collective sense of relief that a monster was off the street.
The Green River Killer was suspected of killing at least 48 women. The problem was that with the evidence they had, the police could only charge Ridgway with four murders. And that was enough to warrant a death penalty. For the prosecution, it was a bargaining chip.
Gary Ridgway's attorney contacted the prosecutor and agreed to waive the death penalty in exchange for a complete confession on all the women that he killed in the King County jurisdiction.
To try and help all the affected families find out what had happened to their loved ones, the deal was made. In 2003, Gary Ridgway confessed to the dozens of murders he had committed. The investigators then contacted the families of the deceased.
That was a day, you know what PTSD is? That's a day that I can feel the emotion because I was at work. And the phone rang and my heart started beating. And they said, you know, we have this person in custody. He has confessed to the murders of so many women. I thought I was going to faint. It was shocking. I never thought in a million years that I would be getting a phone call like that.
On November the 5th, 2003, Ridgway appeared in front of a packed King County courthouse in downtown Seattle and made his plea.
The first time I saw him, it was disappointing. He was kind of a mouse of a man in the minds of so many in the Pacific Northwest as some sort of superhuman, that it was just shocking to see what a little worm of a man he actually was. He tried to apologize at one point, but the father of one of the victims interrupted him with sort of a torrent of emotion, and Ridgway was unable to speak. The father obviously just had to address him. Eventually, you know, he was gavel to order by the judge, but it was a very intense moment.
The only time Gary Ridgway was affected by any words that anyone spoke were when he was forgiven. Interestingly enough, that made me more angry when I saw that. It's like, I just poured my heart out to you, what you've done to our family by taking my sister, and nothing. He had no facial expression whatsoever. I didn't get it.
The first time that they sentenced Gary Ridgway in 2003, I couldn't cry. I was numb. There just was nothing there.
Virginia Graham went to the court to try to understand why Ridgway had killed her sister Deborah over 20 years earlier.
I don't know how another human being could do to somebody else what he put these girls through.
Being in the court that day, there were no pictures of who these victims were. It was just names on a piece of paper. So I wanted him to know that she wasn't a thing, that she was my sister and that she was loved. So I had that picture that I showed to him. She was a little girl when she was murdered by him.
In November 2003, Gary Ridgway was convicted of 48 counts of aggravated murder. He was sentenced to 48 consecutive life terms in prison. When a 49th body was found in December 2010, dumped in Washington, Ridgway was given an additional life sentence.
They found Becky's body. Her remains were found by accident. That was my sister's best friend.
There are so many names, so many victims, and I think it's important that we try and remember all of those women.
In his final statement, an admission of guilt, he said, "I wanted to kill as many women I thought were prostitutes as I possibly could." If anyone truly deserves the title of an evil killer, it is unquestionably Gary Ridgway.
The Green River Killer murdered 49 young women. They may be gone, but for the loved ones left behind, they will never be forgotten.
I can always see her face. She was very fun, very bright, big, beautiful, you know, blonde hair, blue-eyed, angelic little girl.
Sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, the Green River Killer will never be free again. Arguably the most prolific serial killer ever known, Gary Ridgway is without doubt one of the world's most evil killers.